Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and you can catch it later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts delivering all the essential updates you need fast and focused. It's Monday, the 16th of September. On the program today, what kind of movement are we going to see on interest rates this week? As we eagerly await the spring rains, dam levels in three provinces looking dire. More on Pravin Gordhan's legacy and influence on the South African business sector, and could a robot bring an end to workplace disciplinary woes? Well, we read that a prolonged dry season alongside the effects of climate change to blame for dwindling dam levels in various provinces around the country. In government's latest State of the Reservoirs report, the Vaal Dam sitting at around 45%, almost half the capacity that was recorded at the same time last year. The Department of Water and Sanitation at this point does not seem overly worried, though, but is warning consumers to use water wisely. Joining us at the top of the program now is Karen Bosman, Water and Environmental Governance Specialist Advisor, to give us an update on the situation. Karen, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Are you concerned that the Department of Water and Sanitation is not a little more alarmed at the situation?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to all your listeners. I have read the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee minutes of a committee meeting that was held last week with high-level representatives of the Department of Water Affairs, and in which they gave indications of how they've planned and made plans to overcome the current dry season drought spell that we are experiencing. And in that, they've indicated that, you know, the readiness level of various municipalities and the different constraints that's being experienced, as well as the contingencies they have in place. They have also, if your listeners are not aware, already declared water restrictions that are in effect in Gauteng, in Mpumalanga and the Free State since 1 September, which includes things like not watering your garden, not using a running hose pipe to wash your car, and so on, because we are in this period where we're entering the end of the dry season.
Are you satisfied that those measures are enough?
One can never say that it's going to be enough, because we can simply not predict when rainy season starts. You know, in South Africa, we experience drier, irrespective of climate change, we've always had experience drier and wetter cycles, which is around at every 11 years we get a more severe drought, and in the same way, in the height of that, every 11 years we get severe flooding. The implementation of the measures beginning of September means that the department's projections show that we should get our good first seasonal rain by the middle of October. And if that does happen, yes, then the measures would be sufficient. But if we do not get that first big rain in the middle of October, then obviously we are facing with a challenging situation. So I would recommend that people, you know, do their own bit and just be a little bit more careful with the amount of water that they use, because we do not know when rain will stop.
But having said that, we can do as much as we can as consumers, but a lot of the problem has got to do with failing or dilapidated municipal infrastructure. I don't need to tell you how much water is lost through leakage. Surely we need to be a little bit more assertive in adaptive measures as far as that is concerned.
No, you're absolutely right. And here I would like to distinguish between what we refer to as a meteorological drought, when it gets drier because just of the delay of rainy season, the effects of climate change, as opposed to an institutional drought. Now, South Africa has been in an institutional drought for quite a long period of time. And institutionally, you know, fixing leaking pipes, fixing infrastructure, that is an utmost priority. And one cannot overemphasize the importance that especially municipalities have to give urgent attention to any leaks. Any leaks reported must be fixed immediately because we simply cannot afford to lose that water. And in that same breath, many municipalities are owing large amounts of money to the bulk water suppliers, to Rand Water and Bloem Water or Sedibeng Water. And that means that those big water suppliers capability to maintain their infrastructure is also placed in jeopardy. So for this institutional drought, I cannot overemphasize the absolute dire need that one needs to look at differently on how municipalities spend their money to maintain water infrastructure.
And you put the point so well. You say that we can't afford to lose water. Absolutely agree with you. But we also, in many respects, as far as municipalities are concerned, they can't afford to fix it. So we really do have a conundrum here.
We do have a conundrum. And I think in an attempt to address this, the President 2 weeks ago, or a week ago, signed the Water Infrastructure Bill into an act of legislation, which will establish a national oversight infrastructure authority, who will assist with this type of infrastructure maintenance. But what I think is short or lacking in that is the lack of ring fencing of water collected, money collected for. For example, my water and electricity bill can go to, you know, a lavish party for the municipality and is not used for my water infrastructure maintenance. So we need to go beyond just having a national infrastructure authority. We should also look at money measures to ring fence money gained for water infrastructure should be spent on water infrastructure.
And just another question, how critical is the Lesotho Highlands water project right now and the maintenance that it's undergoing in terms of a threat to water supply here in Gauteng?
Well, Jeremy, I want to reassure your listeners on that one. One has to remember that the Lesotho Highlands Water Project started in 1994, and we are now 30 years on, and that every 10 years since, in other words, in 2004, in 2014, and now in 2024, there has been a shutdown for a big-scale maintenance for 6 months. This is not new. It happened in 2004. It happened in 2014. And we, most people, were not even aware of the fact that it happened at those periods. In terms of the delivery or the time frame in which it's shut down from October to March, that is the rainy season. So then there is already water running into the system. And should there be a delay in the rainy season, that it doesn't release water through, there is also water available in the Solplaiki Dam near Bethlehem, as well as in other dams in the Free State Vaal system where water can be released to make up for the cut-off of the Lesotho water supply system. I don't think people will notice that the Lesotho Water Highlands Water Project is under maintenance.
Karin Bosman, thank you very much indeed. Water and Environmental Governance Specialist Advisor. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, it's a big week. The Monetary Policy Committee of the South African Reserve Bank is widely expected to cut interest rates when it meets Thursday. The MPC has raised rates by a massive 475 basis points since 2021 after extreme inflationary pressure hit the South African economy. Obviously, this was following the COVID-19 pandemic that took the repo rate to a 15-year high of 8.25%. So where do we stand this week? Not only in terms of South Africa, but globally. Annabel Bishop is Chief Economist at Investec. Annabel, thank you so much indeed. First of all, let's focus on the United States of America because it has a domino effect. The expected rate cut by the Fed later this week, Wednesday, I think. How is it going to affect global markets and particularly emerging economies like ours?
Yes. Hi, Jeremy. Look, the expectations for a 25 basis point cut that the Fed Funds futures, the financial markets, have actually priced in 40 basis points, which really tells you that they are very certain about this interest rate cut. And because of the certainty, we've actually seen some rand strength. We've seen some positivity come through, seen some moderation in risk aversion. Also, of course, as well, the US dollar is a bit weaker ahead of this first interest rate cut since 2023. 22, we had that big hike, you remember. And then obviously this is the first cut since 2020. But of course, you know, looking forwards now, we obviously are seeing financial markets price in substantial cuts for the United States, and they're looking at 2.5% in total over a year's time. So that, I think, is also adding substantially to positive market sentiment and risk on.
So how much of an impact, Annabelle, will the decision by the US Fed have on the Saab decision? And could it consider something maybe even larger than 50 basis points?
No, I don't think the South African Reserve Bank would move for its first interest rate cut by more than 25 or even more than 50 basis points. Essentially, as we know, the Fed funds futures are pricing in only 40 basis points, and that's not even 50 basis points itself. Look, I think if we look at the South African Reserve Bank commentary that we've seen, they have lowered their inflation forecast quite substantially over the past few meetings, and their inflation forecasts are now at or below the 4.5% mark. And what that really does is that allows the Reserve Bank to start considering interest rate cuts. For us in South Africa, it's quite important what the United States does. When we get a cut in the US, it actually can widen the interest rate differential between the US and South Africa. In fact, with the US expected to cut more than South Africa over the next 12 months, that's also propping up the rand. So, you know, the cut the next day in South Africa, that's anticipated of 25 basis points, that I think has been largely factored in by the markets, and markets are actually now looking ahead for the rest of this year and into early next.
Annabelle, so much of this, of course, is contingent on inflation, and we are starting to see promising signs as far as that's concerned. I guess the key question, though, is one, is it sustainable? And two, within the inflation basket, what are you concerned about?
Yes, that's a very good question, Jeremy. It's all contingent on inflation. And in South Africa, of course, you know, the inflation market's been very heavily influenced by both fuel prices and, of course, as well, food prices. And most recently, we've seen a series of cuts in the fuel price. And, of course, the petrol price has come down quite a lot. Looking forward, it's expected to be another large cut in the petrol price. This will have moderating effect on inflation going forward. And, in fact, the 4.6% inflation outcome we saw recently for July that dropped down from 5.1%, that came partly on the back of base effect. It means that inflation a year ago was saw quite a bit of pressure. So this year we obviously saw a moderation, partly from base effects, partly from the fuel prices I mentioned. Also a key for South Africa as well is agricultural prices, the biggest subcomponent in the basket. Internationally, agricultural prices have come down quite a bit. There's a further big drop coming through as well. This helps to moderate inflation in that area as well. Overall, in fact, Jeremy, the inflation picture is looking pretty good for South Africa, and the next print should see inflation around 4.5% again. After that, it drops towards 4%. And in fact, in the fourth quarter of this year, CPI inflation in South Africa is expected to run under 4.5%.
So significant then, as you say, Annabelle, in stimulating economic growth. But how long would the lag be, and what sectors would benefit the most?
So from an interest rate cut perspective, you know, the lag can really be 2 to 3 quarters, even out to a year after the interest rate cut happens. So that's good news for us, because we expect to see interest rate cuts over the course of next year and even into 2026. Overall, the South African Reserve Bank is likely to cut by 1.25% to 1.5% in this interest rate cutting cycle. And that means that the effects of the interest rate cuts will build up steadily over the course of next year and into the following, and even last a bit longer than that. So that will be a real benefit to the consumer in South Africa, as well, of course, having a positive impact on confidence.
Annabelle, I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that this week is so important. There's so many different variables. You have the Bank of Japan also talking about rate hikes, China experiencing deflationary pressure. Then towards the end of the week, Gulf states could follow the U.S. with a potential rate cut that could have an impact on global energy prices. So it's a big week, is it not?
It's a big week, and you know, the interest rate cycles are turning. We are obviously seeing some reduction in pressure coming through on interest rates from the from Europe, and of course expected to come through from the US and even the UK, and of course South Africa. If we look forwards, these interest rate cuts are not expected to be one-off. They're expected to be part of interest rate cut cycles. So one thing I would say to you is that the markets probably have gone a little bit ahead of themselves, perhaps in the pace of interest rate cuts and the quantum in the United States, and that will probably be a bit tempered. It'll probably be less than that 2.5% over 12 months that markets have currently factored in. The central banks around the world have actually talked about gradualism. We've been talking about other regions, other central banks. And I think what that really means, you know, for us to understand is that it will still be data dependent, interest rate cuts, but also, of course, while they're not going to necessarily rush into big moves either way. And I think, you know, that's probably going to be part of the flavor of monetary policy globally going forwards.
Let me just ask you one final counterpoint question, if I can, Annabelle. Are there potential risks of cutting rates too early, given ongoing and often increasing global economic uncertainties?
I think that's been the fear of central banks. I think that's what's held back the United States. I would say it's almost at risk of cutting too late at the moment. We have seen some areas of weakness in the US economy, nothing to panic unduly about, but also notable areas of weakness. So really what we would say is that financial markets have fully priced in these interest rate cuts. Not cutting would obviously create a very negative impact on financial markets. So I think that from that perspective, we would certainly expect a cut delivered on Wednesday. But, you know, the actual content of the FOMC, the United States Monetary Policy Committee's decision and reasoning around the cut will be equally important, if not more so. They're certainly probably going to give some clarity on how they feel the pace of interest rate cuts should unfold in the United States. And I think that's very key. That might temper some of the market enthusiasm, but no, we certainly wouldn't expect the United States Reserve Bank to heel the Fed on its interest rate cut this week. And the inflationary pressures are quite stubborn, some of which, you know, have almost started to see some structural factors building in. So, you know, we also, of course, as well, have seen the movements in the inflation and food price in South Africa, which has brought us down quicker. Overall, we think that the U.S. is poised for rate cuts, not just at this meeting, but later this year as well and into next year, and that they are going to be watching the labour market particularly closely. Any weakness in the labour market obviously causes substantial concerns in financial markets, and they don't want financial market instability.
Well, let's see what happens later in the week. Annabelle Bishop, Chief Economist at Investec, I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the business community is continuing to reflect on the death of former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, his contribution, and whether he could have done more, particularly in terms of state-owned enterprises. Kas Kuvadia is the Chief Executive Officer of Business Unity South Africa and joins me now. And first of all, Kas, a pivotal figure, Pravin Gordhan, in South Africa's economic and political landscape. Pravin Gordhan was known for his anti-corruption stance. But when all is said and done, and when you reflect on this, did he make any big, real difference?
I think we certainly feel that he made a real difference, particularly when he was at finance and to a certain extent when he was in COGTA, I mean local government. You know, we had a complex relationship with Pravin as business, as Pravin was a complex person. But by and large, I think in his role at SARS, we worked very closely with him and we were very supportive of his efforts to actually position SARS as a globally respected and credible revenue agency, government revenue agency. And we worked with him. I mean, I was at BASA at that time, and the banking sector at that time was the first sector to actually sign an accord with South, primarily because we were able to work with Pravin and agree with him that there be an appropriate tax structure for the banking sector and that the banking sector should play its role in ensuring that they pay what they need to pay. And we reached agreement on all of that when, and were able to manage that and drive that, all because I think the sector respected Pravin and what he was doing, the transparency of South at that time and so on. Then, you know, when he was at Treasury, when Nkandla Nene was fired and the weekend minister came in, and we met with the president fairly urgently, and our insistence was that this guy be fired and Pravin be brought back. That's because in his first term of office as the Minister of Finance, we worked with him very well. I mean, Pravin had his ideas about how the economy should work, and he always put a moral basis to arguments, not just a legal and economic basis. And we understood that. So I think that we were able to talk to him, we were able to work with him, and I think that he was very good for the economy because of the way he conducted himself.
Kaskavadia, also, by design, do you think the relationship between business and the Treasury is always going to be a difficult one, a complex one to navigate?
Absolutely. There are areas of difference. There are areas where we probably wouldn't agree even with the best of intentions. But the thing was navigating with Treasury on a consistent basis, except when Gigaba was minister. But other than that, on a consistent basis, although the relationship was complex, it was a relationship that we could manage because of the professional approach that Treasury took toward that relationship, as did Pravin when he was minister. And so we recognized the complexities of the relationship, but we managed it because Treasury always conducted the relationship, and we conducted the relationship on the basis of not, you know, pie in the sky stuff, but empirically based research and evidence. And it's on that basis that we related to each other. So it wasn't about ideology and so on. It was about what's good for this country and where we can actually reach compromise between business and Treasury to take things forward.
It is accepted, though, that during his tenure as finance minister, public debt did rise sharply.
Yeah, public debt did rise sharply, but we've always taken the view that while Treasury has been professional, Treasury has had the sort of capacity to actually work with business and guide this country's finances, it's not the only player in the room. Treasury can take certain views, can actually warn the country about high budget deficits, can warn the country about the dangers of having high debt service costs and so on. But at the end of the day, budgets are decided by cabinet. And if whichever minister is in Treasury, if his or her colleagues are not brought into line, actually be responsible about the way they utilize money and be responsible about the understanding that the country does not have a trough of money that can be used at any time. And Treasury can only do so much. So I think that the fact that we had serious debt that time, I don't think it only lies at the doors of the Treasury. It's subsequent to the budget process. It's how departments conduct themselves and whether they actually keep to the budget that their ministers have agreed to. And so it's an all-of-government approach. And if all-of-government is brought into line to conduct themselves in a way that they utilize monies responsibly, that they understand the limitations on budgets that Treasury can prepare, you can have any minister in Treasury and they'll still run up deficits. And so I think that certainly our view was always, and if you look at in multilateral discussions that we used to have at places like NEDLAC and so on, we were always supportive of Treasury and the approach they took towards budgets and the approach they took towards trying to control the country's debt And if you look at inputs given by Treasury at NEDLAC meetings on budget, they were absolutely consistent that we can't afford this, we can't do this, we are seriously concerned about the debt spiraling, and therefore this is what we're presenting. And there were all sorts of criticism from people like Labour and community groups and so on, but business was consistently supportive of Treasury because they had, call it a conservative approach to budgeting, but they had an approach to budgeting that took into account the reality that we face in this country.
Let me ask you a question about that line that you've just used, the all of government approach. And is it fair to say that with his retirement and then subsequent passing, there is now more concern about the future of ongoing reform within state entities?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, one of Pravin's legacies, I guess, is that he brought all of these things to the fore. He was consistent on that. And I think that now, particularly in the current administration, I think that there is more concern on that. And I think that what Pravin sort of tried to do at that time and warned about, I think that chickens came home to roost. And we now have a government, I think, that would be more concerned about this and would try to actually manage government business in a way that, Pravin, while he was at Treasury, but Treasury generally has been actually promoting for quite a few, for many, many years.
I'm going to leave it there. Kas Kavadia, thank you very much indeed. Business Unity South Africa. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And I want to end with this. Artificial intelligence technology increasingly being implemented in workplace functions, but you may find this one surprising. Global Business Solutions, it's a local consulting and training firm specializing in labor law and HR consulting, has launched a world-first AI-powered inquiry bot that I'm told could revolutionize a workplace disciplinary procedure. More now from John Buerter, who is Joint Chief Executive at Global Business Solutions. John, welcome. So what inspired you to develop this particular function, and how does it work?
Good day to you and the listeners, Jeremy. Thank you. So what inspired me was at the end of last year, going into December, I just became so aware that artificial intelligence is not limited, Jeremy. It's a bottomless pit of opportunities, in fact. And one of the processes that is probably avoided as much as possible in organizations is the maintenance of discipline, certainly by line managers who have to initiate these processes, and then also the chair people. So it's a lengthy process, it's very structured, and it lends itself to automation.
So how does it ensure then accuracy and consistency in any disciplinary procedure, John? And how would it compare then, and I guess it's early stages for you, to traditional human-led process?
So the robot starts off with the what we call the initiator. So that is the immediate line manager. And the line manager would effectively, get onto the bot and describe. It would be prompted, and the line manager would then just in plain English describe what the incident was, whether it's absenteeism, theft, poor performance, whatever. The robot would then ask for the disciplinary code of that particular company to be uploaded, and it would then generate certain charges and allegations against the individual. And Jeremy, it draws that from a body of knowledge. So the Labor Relations Act, codes of good practice, even case law is then referred to as the body of knowledge that informs this machine learning. So the initiator ends up with much more detailed, technically aligned, and legally astute charges against the employee. And then from there onward, Jeremy, basically it prompts the initiator to upload witness statements. So it generates opening statements. We see LA law type, evidence in chief, cross-examination. It prepares all of that for the line manager, which is really, really exciting. And the line manager will be better prepared than ever for that.
Now, I don't need to tell you that all AI technology at this nascent phase, John, comes with risk, whether it be data privacy or, in your particular case, system error. What measures, then, are you implementing to mitigate these risks and ensure security, given that people's lives and livelihood is on the line here?
Yes. So obviously we've piloted this, Jeremy, for some time, and we've used real life case studies. We've de-identified hearings and put it through. And, you know, as you say, it's not an exact science as yet. Maybe at 2030, I hear that, you know, AI will be more intelligent than you and I, but certainly we've run case studies and we're confident that on the whole, the outcome is much more intelligent, objective, consistent, and fair than an average line manager or an average chairperson.
How do you convince a person that their future within an organization is effectively being decided by a bot?
Well, the quality assurance, Jeremy, around this obviously requires human intervention. So this bot is an augmentation as opposed to a full automation. So at the various checkpoints, you still have to have human oversight. And obviously, that's a point in time, probably technical legal advice. But the big benefit, you know, besides the obvious improvement in the quality of the outcomes and the charges and the findings, is just the significant time saving. You know, these disciplinaries can drag on for hours, sometimes for weeks. And then the chairperson needs to try and make sense of tons of information, evidence, witness statements, and policies. You literally upload that, Jeremy, put it through the process, and at least it gives the chairperson a point of departure. Clearly, it can't be used as is. It's got to be, you know, a quality assured.
That point is absolutely taken. The other thing, of course, that would be of concern would be ethics in terms of fairness and bias, which again would still, at this point, require human intervention.
You're absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. The difference, though, is the human intervention comes on the back end of a large language model having been processed. So as opposed to the human being have to now start literally and going from scratch and retype and try and make sense of tons of information and then to try and align it to labor law and case law, it generates that and gives you a foundation from which to build. So it's really time-saving, it's a productivity, and as I say, on the whole, the outcomes are very, very positive. And in my view, Jeremy, human beings, chairperson, judge, I heard your previous conversation with Cascavadia around, you know, some of the challenges we face as a country and even the legislative system. You know, in my experience, this robot is infinitely less biased than a human being.
Thank you very much indeed. John Boerter, Joint Chief Executive Officer at Global Business Solutions. There you go, a glimpse into the future of labor law in South Africa. Just before I leave you on our poll today, we spoke about this a little earlier, South Africa's water supply warning. Do you think it's being taken seriously enough? Do you think it's under control? Or do you think the real problem is around infrastructure and that more spending and funding is needed? If you have a view on that, I would like to hear from you on either X or LinkedIn, and I'll bring you the results of that poll on the program tomorrow. That's also our show for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.